I want to talk a little bit tonight and through this month, I think, a little bit going back to some basics, particularly for tonight, welcoming some new folks here and in general using the first week of the month to renew or refresh some of the basic instructions. And I want to talk about meditation itself. We've been talking a bunch about doctrines and kind of deeper or more abstract Buddhist concepts for a few months now. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the formal practice of meditation. And maybe a good place to start is that the word meditation isn't that helpful in many ways. It's a word from the Christian tradition and isn't really a direct translation of any particular Sanskrit or Pali word, any particular Buddhist or Hindu word to translate as meditation. The closest word from the early Buddhist tradition, which is my main home base here that I teach from, is the word bhavana, which means something like cultivation. And it might just mean practice in a certain way. And I think this is an important distinction because what has come down to us as quote-unquote meditation in many ways has come from multiple traditions, and those multiple traditions are not necessarily in agreement about what the core practice is. And I'll give you a basic example of this, which is that in the early Buddhist texts, known as the Pali Canon, when the Buddha talks about what one does when one sits down, crosses one's legs, sits upright, and takes on a formal practice, two things are talked about. Most of the time, when this practice of sitting down and developing a state of mind is described, it's described in terms of a set of mind states called jhana or dhyana. And jhana is the early Buddhist word. And a good translation of that is absorption. And it's a way of saying that the thing one should do once one sits down and to assemble one's mind state is to gather the energies of the body mind and focus the attention in quite a profound way, so that qualities like steadiness, like pleasure in the body, like energy arise, happiness, contentment arise, clarity, and eventually one-pointedness or single-pointedness, which we might describe this whole thing as like profound non-distraction is the thing that's being talked about. And I say profound because these are states that are pretty substantially different from anything we're in our day-to-day life. They're, if you know the term flow states, they're a little bit like extremely deep flow states. You know what it's like when you're sitting and you land with the breath and you feel the breath come in and you feel the breath go out. And for whatever reason, the mind is just not so distracted in that moment. And there's not even that kind of little restless energy where it wants to pull away. The mind just stays, even for one breath, in a kind of not so much effort, steadiness, and very little is happening. There's just the breath rising and falling, and you're right there with it. That is the flavor of these deep states called jhana. And this is the main thing that it seems like the early tradition is pointing toward cultivating as a mind state in the sitting posture. And the descriptions of these things get deep fast. Very quickly, they're talking about states where the whole body is saturated with pleasure or cool ease or contentment. So one of the directions in meditation is to cultivate that. The other side of the practice in the early tradition is comes from particularly one or two texts that focus on what we now translate as mindfulness. These texts, rather than describing the mind state that one enters into, describe what one should pay attention to. And the text says, essentially, assemble your energy, sit clearly, be bright, and then notice the breath coming and going. Notice the postures of the body. Notice movement as you're moving around. Notice that the body is composed of basic sensations. Notice that all of your perceptions can be broken down into sets of very basic qualities. Notice that you're going to die. These are these kind of categories of early meditation practice. Notice that everything is either pleasant or unpleasant or kind of neither. That there's a charge or a quality to all your experiences. And the list goes on. It says this is from a text known as the Foundations of Mindfulness text. So these two ways of practice, one says get very, very still and focused, and the other one says get still and focus on these things. In both cases, we're being asked to cultivate a mind state. And in both cases, that mind state is energized and focused and directed, not wide open, but really kind of channeled towards seeing certain things very clearly. So I'll call this the cultivation style of meditation. Technically, it's just call it vipassana, for lack of a better word, referring to the kind of early Buddhist style. And that's one of the big traditions that came to the West. So that's one of the things that a lot of folks think of when it's like, oh, I'm going to meditate. They think like, well, I'm going to focus on my breath and try to think less. Or I'm going to try to notice my actions as I move around. Right? I'm going to try to be mindful. But then here's an example of something else entirely. One of the other big traditions to come to the West was the Zen tradition, and particularly the Soto Zen tradition, which is just one of the several branches of Japanese Zen. It's one of the more popular that arrived here. It's the basis of like the San Francisco Zen Center style. And that style teaches a kind of meditation called Zazen, which a good translation might be, or a common translation is just sitting. And an instruction in that tradition might be that to sit begins with really focusing on the posture and really coming into a kind of deep clarity of posture, a brightness through the hands and arms, really lining up the spine, lining up the head and the neck and the shoulders. In that tradition, they sit with eyes open. And having done that, then the instruction would be, and just do that. In other words, don't do anything else. You don't need to focus on any particular thing. There's nothing to become. There's nowhere to get to. And some of the texts associated with this tradition say things like to sit is already to be the Buddha. Nothing is gained by sitting. Because if you could become enlightened by sitting, somehow that would mean that there was something that you were not already. So simply to take the shape is already to express the fullness And you might get the instruction to do non-doing. Or just that there's nowhere to get to, and there's nothing to do, and there's no point to sitting. Which, when the Zen people say it, it sounds very profound. I'm only teasing them slightly. I practiced in that tradition for 6 years. In the beginning of my practice, I did a lot of it. And I respect it deeply as an expression of perfection. But I notice that when I talk to folks about meditation, these two traditions that are separate from each other by several thousand miles of geography and about 2 millennia of historical development, at least 1 millennium of historical development, they get kind of mashed up. But if you feel into them, one of the traditions is saying, like, hone and focus your mind state in these very specific ways. Generate these qualities. Do these things. And the other one says, open wide and do nothing. So this can be challenging, because not only are those instructions very different, but a lot of us who practice in contemporary Buddhism, convert Buddhism, have studied in both traditions and have a tendency to kind of mash up our instructions. So there's people who will give you both instructions. And this shouldn't, I hope that this isn't too confusing. What I want is for this to be clarifying. They're both beautiful ways to practice. But I find it more and more just valuable to know what I'm trying to do. What instructions am I actually following? And mostly when I sit down now, the beginning of my impulse is, in a way, just to come through the fog or the swirl that is kind of my mind's habitual state, or it's what my busy life is conditioning. Right? And both of these kinds of practice, like one says just rest and be open and just keep letting go and it'll clarify. And the other one says, you know, brighten and focus and go toward clarity. The beginning of both is the same. Like, whatever you think you're doing, you sit down and, you know, you're a little achy, the mind is a mess, whatever's happening in your life is what's happening. And so the first moments in practice are very often just a coming into presence with that. We can understand both of these styles of practice. If we call one the doing method and one the just being method. Before you can do either, before you can be either, before you can do be either, there's a first waking up that we have to find. And this waking up is almost, it'd be a very Zen thing to say, this is the whole path. I think it's not the whole path, but it might be the whole path. Which is to say that there's this initial surfacing from sleepwalking or from the non-presence that can be our habitual norm. And I come into presence. In one of my other traditions, we call this orientation. One way of saying it is like, I arrive in the room from wherever I've been. I've been worried about something, I've been planning something, thinking about something, churning in whatever way, and something assembles. Either it does it on its own, or I do it, or somehow the conditions come together for it to happen, where I come out of that trance. And what's left is really simple, actually. It's kind of just ordinary being here. What this feels like to me often is like just a little brightening of my senses. Like the visual field, my hearing, my felt sense of my body, all gets just a little bit more like, you know, like I'm in iPhoto and I just turned up the color a little bit and the whole photo kind of got like, popped the reds a little, something like that. Everything gets a little brighter. I'm like, oh look, I'm here. Cool. And then I start sitting. And very often the first moments, like I just drop in, and the very first moments are this kind of like, ah, finally, a little stillness. And then I'm thinking about something again. And I kind of launch out of that stillness. And one of the most common kind of traps in beginning meditation is to think that the point is to stop thinking. Right? Oh, I have to stop. Which I'm, as a meditation teacher, I'm supposed to say that's not the point. But a subtler truth is that it's half the point. It's not the point in that if I'm trying to stop thinking, I will mostly fail, right? Because you can't not think using will for more than a few seconds, most people. What is true is that quieting the stream of discursive thought is actually really important. And it is one of the natural results of meditation practice deepening is longer periods of quiet, steadiness. Both of the qualities we looked at in our meditation practice this evening, deepening rest and turning up or clarifying focus, increasing both rest and focus, both of those, as they mature, will lead to a quieter thinking stream for periods of time. So it's not that it's all about not thinking, but thinking less becomes part of it. This isn't license to start blaming yourself whenever a thought arises. That's hell, because they'll keep coming, so you're doomed if that's your practice. But from this initial waking up into presence and the first moments of sitting, often relaxing, just dropping in, from that first dropping in, there's going to be an oscillation. And you can really start to feel in your practice that there's this kind of wave that happens where there's a little wave of relaxation, of settling, and then a wave of activation where a thought or another layer of feeling comes. And you could think of it like as we deepen in rest and brighten focus, each step of those qualities deepening brings us more into contact with a layer of what's here. So like as I relax, one of the things I'll come into contact with at some point is the ache in the body, right? Whatever's been hurting. If I relax more and more, eventually some of that's going to appear. and need to be processed, need to be felt. Often if it can be felt deeply, and maybe it needs something else, it needs attention in a stretchy kind of way, or who knows, that layer gets worked through, I keep relaxing, it disappears or changes, and I relax, and something else will arise. Right? Oh, I thought I was working through that ache, and then I got quieter and quieter, and then I hit a layer that I call, like, bone tired, just like deep exhausted. And that's not the first thing I encounter, because the first thing I encounter is more like than that. But if I work through that and keep dropping in, then there's that layer. Like, oh. And I kind of don't mind that layer so much. There's some way that when I get there, I'm like, oh, okay. Like, you can't really fight it anyway. Like, once you're there, you're just there. But it's also true that continuing to relax and you drop through it, and there's something else on the other side. There's always something else on the other side. So you keep dropping. Likewise, when you focus, you see clearly first when you focus whatever's on the surface. So like, oh, my mind's really busy with worry about this project. As focus gathers, I'm both going to get moments of a break, mind quiet, and then I'm going to see more clearly when the mind leaps into its thing, when it gets a little activated and it jumps into a cycle. And it's going to be like, oh, there's that thing again. I'm worried about this project. And as I practice, right, I'm going to have to process the activation of that thing, whatever it is, on the surface. Oh, I'm worried about the project. Oh, okay, so there's spinning thoughts. So I come back, but what I come back to is the body. And so then the next layer down from spinning thoughts is like, oh, I'm afraid. I'm afraid it's not going to go well. And then I have to feel that and be present with that. I breathe with it. I hang out with it. I'm like, okay, this is fear. As I stay with it, if I can do it skillfully, it dissolves. Other times, right, it's too much for me to handle. I touch into it, and then it explodes in more thought, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm really, really freaking out about this thing. And that's happened sometimes too, right? Because I dropped down deeply enough to contact it. And then it's like, whoa, that's what's here. Right? If that's what happens, often the skillful thing is to surface again. Right? So that might mean like, oh, open my eyes, look around, move the body, be like, whoa, okay. I sat down to sit, I thought I was gonna meditate, and actually I'm freaking out. It's like, cool. All right, whoa, freaking out. And you're just kind of like, that's what that is. And it feels like just kind of like work it through. And if that doesn't work, I'm like, time to go for a walk. Like, get up, move it out. Because if this model is correct, and I think it is, that that part of our practice in meditation, in a sense, is to drop into ourselves layer by layer and to have to deal with or process or purify would be the ancient word, what we find in each layer, then I need the tools to address whatever I find in each layer. And sometimes that tool is going to be relax more deeply into it. Sometimes the tool is going to be focus. Other times the tool is going to be come out of it, right? Like, don't go deeper in there. Know that it's there, but kind of just bow to it and let it be. And all of that is going to be this kind of practice of maneuvering through my psyche as I settle. The states that we're going for, profoundly relaxed, bright attention, or to say them in the Zen language, deeply present, wide open, unguarded. These states require the slow building of a foundation of well-being. And so, whatever flavor of instruction feels like it resonates for you, the beginnings of practice are the same. And they are to build that foundation another way of saying what that foundation is it's a kind of resilience in which I know that I can be present with whatever I find in myself as I deepen. And as that resilience builds, my strength builds, practice becomes kind of like a strange internal adventure story. Like, meditation can get kind of trippy. At the very least, it can be a psychological process. It can be tremendously painful. Sorry, new people. It can also be tremendously blissful, like profoundly pleasurable, which is strange. I'm just sitting here. All of this is built on the foundation of my own ability to meet with some intimacy whatever I experience. And that's both the foundation for deepening in practice, and it's the one of the goals that practice is going toward. So this isn't really a talk about different historical or cultural styles of meditation, but a talk attempting in a way to define what meditation is in the way that I'm presenting it, in a way that I hope is useful in a really concrete way. And I want to stay as concrete as I can for a bit here. One of the things we begin to notice as we practice is that both in formal meditation and throughout our day, our attention, our psyche, this part of ourselves that connects with experience and then releases it and connects and releases, that it's oscillating all the time. That something pings my attention in the present moment, which it means, in a way, through my physical senses. I see something or hear something or smell or taste or feel a sensation. And my attention comes toward that. I connect with it. There's a kind of intimacy in presence. I feel the texture of the cloth of my pants on my knee, and the temperature. And I don't have to think about it. There's nothing to do with it. There's nothing to become around it. But I can notice that when my hand landed there, for a micro moment, my attention went right there. In a very simple way, we just call this perception, right? You notice things. This is the quality that the whole system is built on. There's sense experience, perception of it, and there's a consciousness, there's a connecting with it. And in a way, this is all that's happening constantly. But our experience seems to be divided between the sense perceptions that are present, like they're here and now, and the sense that we kind of lump together under the mind, where there's this thing called thought, and its deeper layer, feeling, where we have this amazing ability to connect not just with things that are in the coming through the physical senses, but to connect with words and images and felt sense of things that are not actually happening. things that might happen in the future or happened in the past. And part of the mystery of practice is that, like, those things are just perceptions like anything else. I perceive words in my mind, I perceive images. The question the yogis, the practitioners ask is, what is it about that activity that causes so much distress? Why am I, or the more basic question is, why am I unhappy? If everything is just happening and the mind connects with things as they happen, sometimes it's a thought, sometimes it's a physical sense. What is this thing called, I'm dissatisfied? And the Buddhist answer from the early tradition was that dissatisfaction, distress, profound kind of existential suffering happens when we connect with the thinking quality in a way that runs away from physical reality. And the metaphor used in early texts was this. A man comes to a doctor with an arrow sticking out of his chest. And the doctor says, you know, good Lord, you've been shot. Let me take that arrow out and clean the wound. And the man says, wait, before you take it out, I want to know, you know, I need to know, like, who shot it, and where were they from, and what caste were they, and what family were they from, and, you know, what were they doing when they shot it, and why did they do it, and why me, and tell me all about it, right? I want to know all the reasons, the causes, the conditions for this. And the Buddha says, that man would die before he got all those answers. And there's the sense that, like, there's the wound itself, which is physical, and then there's this obsessive kind of churning around it that is actually much of what's distressing us and is preventing us from the clear solution, which is to take the arrow out and clean it, for which you don't need to know why. And the Buddha gave this as an answer to people who were asking him complicated questions about karma. You know, why are things happening the way they are? It's a parable really about, also about how our mind has this activity of trying to make us a story that makes sense for everything. It wants to tell me why things are happening and how they're happening and what I should do and what I shouldn't do, and constantly explaining things in various ways, including, like, who I am and what I like and what I don't like, all essentially kind of commentary and worry and et cetera. And the suggestion is that it's all of this activity, actually, that's making us miserable. And the actual physical experience of existence is sometimes dreadful and sometimes lovely, but that it's, in a way, that's just nature. That's just being an organism in an ecosystem. Right? So many of the early reflections are things like, you know, my back aches a little bit, which is true in this moment. And I could either just know in a deep way, in a profound way, that this is a body that came into being because of certain conditions. I was born, I've been growing, I've been eating, I'm still alive. And that the nature of having a body is that it aches sometimes, it gets getting older. And that if I really knew that, like really, really, in a profound way, there would be no distress around this ache. It's just an ache in my back. And that doesn't mean that I wouldn't like stretch it. I might be like, oh, that feels good, do a little stretch. But what if I could do that without suffering at all, without any distress at all? The tradition suggests that it's actually everything I construct around it. Oh, my back aches. It aches because I haven't been doing so much yoga, because I have this toddler. But that really means I'm not a very good yogi, or maybe I'm just getting older. I don't want to get older. It means I'm going to die. I'm afraid of dying. Like every implication that could possibly come from a little backache comes. And if we trace these, again, if our meditation practice is to perceive what's happening and to kind of drop down a layer by relaxing and focusing, so many of those, that churning thought is going to drop back down into some really basic feelings like fear of old age, fear of pain, fear of death, self-criticism or criticism of others, complaining, essentially. Right? What if the whole Buddhist message is like, stop complaining? You'll be fine. It's fine. Everything is just going to be the way it is. What if we could stop complaining? So then our basic meditation practice says that we need to find initially, first, just the coming out of the fog of habit, which really means the fog of thought. We come into the physical senses. This is a profoundly embodied practice. So you come in and you sit down, feel the sitting down. Set up your posture in a way that it brightens the body. And brightens doesn't mean bring more effort. Brightens means bring your attention into it so that I'm not elsewhere. Arrive with the body and then arrive in the room and then arrive in myself. Here's the breath. Here's where my thoughts are mostly going. Here's the feeling that's fueling those thoughts. And then here's the body that feels that feeling. And this is the cycle, right? As I relax and focus, I drop a layer in. That layer reveals content, which is going to be thought and feeling. Sensation, bless you. Thought and feeling and sensation, whatever I encounter, if I can, I feel through the body, through the whole heart, I settle into that. And that brings me back to body, out of story. The feelings do what they do. I know them. I'm intimate with them as they swirl around. They settle eventually. And that's a whole process in learning how, but they do, I promise. And then there's a pause in the cycle. I settle again. Come back to breath and drop another layer. And the whole thing repeats. Another layer of mind content that is fueled by feeling content that you can feel in the body. Feeling in the body brings you back. Content subsides, which means heals, which means processes. This is not always quick, but it goes in those waves. And it goes on that way. As you deepen, the layers sometimes feel like micro layers, like little fluctuations moment to moment. Other times, a layer can take a year to move through. It feels like every time I sit down, I'm in the same territory. And I just keep staying with it. And at some point, I realize I'm no longer in that layer and something else is happening. That's how it works. It seems to work. And at some point in that, then the possibility of these deep instructions starts to open. The possibility to just rest at ease with the cycle, letting it be. Or enough clarity generated that I can gather my energy and cultivate and move forward. we'll pause there. We'll continue through this month talking about some of the basics of the meditation practice, some technical and whatever technical means, basics of meditation. Fleshing out the formal practice. But any questions or thoughts here for tonight?
Are there equivalents of the jhana states in Zen tradition? Or is that not even really a thing that's talked about?
Not really. Which doesn't mean they're not happening.
Right?
Because language is really interesting.
Yeah.
In the Zen literature, there's almost a rejection of concentration samadhi because it takes a certain amount of will, even in a kind of effortless way, to relax that deeply. You have to... one of my friends who was practicing them said, oh, jhana, like, yeah, you know, you got to really push to get those things. Which is interesting, but don't take that literally. Push means, like, relax and do nothing really, really profoundly, but in a very, very continuous way. So it's an interesting kind of effort. It does seem like the instruction toward openness and non-choosing of a single point of meditative focus means that those states won't arise as easily. What I'll propose that I see, and this would just be an interesting panel discussion with a bunch of Zen people and Vipassana people, would be, I would propose that the states of meditation that arise in Zen for senior practitioners, really lots of practice, are probably more akin to what gets described like in the Dzogchen and Mahamudra tradition. This is no longer a beginner's night discussion, as from your question. But here's a way of talking about that. Jhana in the early system is based on single-pointed attention on one meditative object, generally. So, like, if I'm watching the breath, this means, like, I stay with the breath without distraction for, you know, 15 minutes to an hour without a single thought. And if I do that a whole bunch, maybe no thoughts at all for several days. That's folks who are really working on those states. So... And you do that by focusing on one thing and staying with it. So there's a focus on the object, like the breath or whatever you do. In the Zen systems and these other varieties that I mentioned, which are Tibetan lineages, Dzogchen and Mahamudra, are also what's called objectless meditation. And the idea there is that you're not choosing a single thing to focus on, but awareness itself is steady. So, it's a little bit like this. Jhana might be like having a camera with an incredible zoom lens, focusing in on a single thing and staying there with it. And really like getting a incredible close-up, profoundly detailed shot of one thing. The open awareness practices might be like having a camera with a really big panoramic lens and just setting it up at a vista and watch and just not focusing on anything but letting everything come and go. Birds come and go, fly in, fly out. You know, it's much more of an ambient shot, but the thing that is stable is the camera itself. So you can try this. Take a moment and choose one sensation that you can feel in your body. I'm going to choose like the pressure of my butt on the cushion because it's potent enough that I can sense it. Sense it and see if you can stay with it for like until I say the next word without flickering at all. Really focus just on that one sensation. Okay, so that's concentration, right? And if you're like me, you might notice, how many people would say you noticed, like, even if your attention stayed there, you can feel a little tug, like a little energetic, like it takes me a little oomph to stay. There's a little pull away, even if words haven't yet arisen. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So that's the force, the technical word would be restlessness in the mind, that concentration has to learn to push against, to stay. And if you do that for several breaths, it gets easier quickly. Like that pull softens within a minute or two. But it's sneaky and you gotta stay. Here's the other kind of practice. Let's go in through the visual field and go ahead and just let your gaze kind of lift to take in the whole room. And don't look at anything in particular, but see if you can actually log the whole range of your vision. See what it's like. Try not to stare at any one object, but actually stay perceiving the whole field. What's that like? What's the difference in the mind quality between those two ways of using your attention?
It's easier.
The wide open one is easier. Uh-huh. Is that true for others?
Mm-hmm.
How many folks found the first one easier? Yeah, so it's always going to be a big, and this might even be a personality typology. Like some folks are just going to have a mind that does that more readily. And some that does that more readily.
Is it introvert and extrovert?
Maybe. I wonder. What else? What do you notice about the kind of the what you're doing in your attention or the quality or the difference between those?
There's also a tug, but it's the opposite. It's the tug to focus.
That's interesting, right? Mm-hmm. For me too. I feel like I kind of open wide up and then something kind of grabs my attention, like, you know, the little peephole on the door, or the, and it's like, oh, in the, and we could think of them in terms of contraction and expansion. In the contracted one, the pull is a little expansive. Jump over there. In the expansive one, the pull is to contract, right? Land here, land there. So they're both valuable skills. The wide open one is in many of the traditions, in the Tibetan tradition, is considered much harder. It's considered to be an advanced practice. And the most extreme version of that is called Anuttara Yoga Tantra, the highest yoga tantra. In other words, it's the absolute pinnacle of the most secret, but I'm going to tell you what it is anyway, practice at the height of the entire system. And it consists of this. Don't do anything. Right? Let everything be just the way it is. That's it. Done. Highest yoga tantra. But, of course, it's tremendously difficult because as soon as you try to do that, you're not doing it. You're like, oh, let everything be just the way it is. A little itch in my eye. Okay, now I'm going to let everything be just the way it is. Oh, wait, I was lost in thinking about something. I'm just going to let everything be the way it is. Oh, now I'm pretending. See, like, it's just really, it's profoundly subtle. And one of the traditions that teaches this says, short glimpses many times. In other words, you can't even sustain it. It's the kind of thing you get a little flicker of. And it's almost like a little flicker of enlightenment. Like, everything is just the way it is. That's a liberation phrase. So you get a little hint of that. And then ordinary reality comes back in. You focus on something. And so in my experience, I agree with the tradition that says actually learning to focus and consciously relax and build up these concrete foundations for me is more accessible and in many cases I think useful in the beginnings of practice. And by beginnings, that could mean anywhere from 3 to 20 years, depending on your, you know,
aptitude,
karmic conditions. Yeah. So in the Zen tradition, to answer your question, I think that there's for sure folks who have gotten good at that wide open state. And if you get good at that, there's different absorption states because it's just a different mental quality. But they can be just as quiet, just as rapturous, but feel very different. And I think different personalities are drawn to the different practice systems. And the manifestation is different. The Zen teachers and masters, they behave differently. Like, hanging out in that state makes you a different kind of person than hanging out in that state. And so that's interesting as well. They have ethical ramifications, I think, in terms of action. You know, how you move in the world really depends on the kind of states you're hanging out in all the time. It's the main thing it depends on. So the two kinds of practice actually condition different kinds of practitioners. Even if ultimately reality is just the way it is. Any other thoughts or questions?
Well, I wanted to just kind of clarify what you were talking about a little before. You when you're meditating, you come into your space and you're kind of in this swimmy thing, and then you settle, and then you have that sort of in the first few moments, and then thoughts come up.
Yeah.
So you have the content.
Yeah.
And then you have the feelings under there, and then you said you feel the feelings, and then maybe that's something you feel in your body, and that processes them, and then you can maybe then go to a deeper level, and then content comes up at that level, and then you have the feelings that's fueling that, and you feel the feelings, and you feel it in your body, and then maybe that processes that, and then...
And of course, this is a totally idealistic, simplified map. But what if it kind of works like that? Thoughts always, like the thoughts that really stick us always have a feeling behind them.
Yeah.
And feelings always have a bodily component.
Yeah.
And contact with the body, with my attention, is in the present moment always, because sensation is present.
Yeah.
Therefore, there's always this kind of loop. And it sometimes goes in the micro. Like I notice a thought and I come back and I notice the next breath. And that's that whole thing in the micro.
What do you mean?
Like, oh, I'm thinking about the project again. Okay, and I come back and I notice that I'm just a little anxious. But I reconnect with my breath and I feel that kind of buzziness. And I'm like, yep. And here's the in-breath.
Yeah.
I get bland again. Like... I think that sequence is actually just what we get in the basic meditation instructions that say when the mind wanders, bring it back.
Well,
but this is a sort of deeper breaking down of it, and particularly I'm asserting more strongly than my tradition often does that there are particular ways that we can work with obsessive thought. By engaging more directly with the feeling fuel behind them, in the body.
Because you said it's sort of simplistic, but to me it seems helpful.
Good. That's the goal. I like to feel helpful.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I like it when you're helpful too.
Good. Good. You come, offer some money. I come, offer some helpfulness. Sometimes both of those things align. It's great.
Good segue.
Totally. So, we'll talk more about this month. And the sense that, and for those new, welcome. Part of what we'll look at here and sort of flesh out is a way of approaching the formal practice of meditation, so sitting still and doing something. That's my translation of bhavana now. Yes. Sit still and do something. Or don't do something, as it were. And we'll flesh out what it might look like to build up the skills that allow me to just to not get stuck over and over in the same place. So to really, how do you work with repetitive thought? How do I work with the layers of feeling that so kind of guide me or unfold as the building blocks of my life? And then how do I actually learn to settle, to land in stillness, not just for a moment at a time and then just get lost again, but like there really are concrete ways to deepen in that even from the very beginning of practice. And so we'll dig into some of those processes this month, working with thought, feeling, and the body. So, pleasure. Happy to see everyone. Welcome to new folks. Good to meet you. We have the rare privilege of offering this class at the studio fully on the practice of gift economy, meaning that there's the invitation to offer your resources in the form of money or whatever, but generally money, to support the series. One way to think about gift economy is not that it's a donation per se, which in a sense implies that this is kind of a free thing, and then a donation is a little bit like a tip. It's not actually that. The studio and their time and their space and my time and space are all actually kind of expensive. But operating the class in the spirit of the gift economy or in the technicality of gift economy is a way of saying that one of the qualities that we aim to cultivate is a joyous, open heart. And in the Buddhist tradition, it's understood that the basis of openness is generosity, which really just means relationship, right? Connecting with others, being available for others. And so practicing gift economy here essentially means that if you have the resources to offer generously of your resources for the group, it means that we can continue to do it. And that folks who have less resources can come, but also just that we get to do something that is not for sale and that it really lives in a different realm. It also means that the offering is more difficult than just paying the price. It means it's a practice. So I'll invite you to practice with this very ancient tradition and to support the group out of your joy that it exists, rather than as yet another transaction in a world where transactions are getting darker by the day. So thank you for your generosity. You can offer money in the wooden box back in the cupboard or at the desk or cards and other things at the desk out there. And what you offer is split between the studio and myself.